him in mid-April, I'm not sure, but Ernie did write Phil then, saying he understood that Phil was getting considerable advice on the coming marriage and thought he'd pass you on some. He wrote, "In the first place, you and the young lady are the people who are getting married, and I have always felt that the contracting parties should do as they please. I might retell how your mother and I got hitched. We eloped or drove off with a team of broncos with our red setter dog as a witness, guardian, or companion or what. We were married at Sturgis by a Presbyterian minister, left horses and dog, and went to Rapid City, 20 miles, by R.R. for one day, and got back to Terry with about $2, but the knot tying stuck, which is the main thing. Boy, I wish you all the joy and success in the world. I am anxious to meet Catherine, as we all are. You tell her I said to keep you in the middle of the road." Ernie eventually wrote me a sweet letter saying Phil has displayed the best judgment that he has shown so far. I hope you can keep him in line, and I will just turn him over to you and quit worrying. You know how it is when a farm boy goes to the city. Pa and Ma are always worrying that some of the wild women and so on may get him. In the end, Phil didn't invite his father to the wedding, but said we would drive down to see his family afterwards. In part, he was angry over Ernie's early objections to our marriage. I believe, too, he was concerned about his father's seeing my parents' large house and number of servants, and the way we lived, all of which indeed would have shocked him. In fact, I believe my father and he would have overcome that. They had many things in common. I came to know and admire, and finally to love Ernie Graham, Phil's two-fisted, rough-hewn, upright father. After we publicly announced our engagement, by which point many people already knew, we were caught up in the excitement and in being celebrated. There was one bad week when the engagement was almost broken. We went to a dinner dance with my brother Bill. Phil had had a great deal too much to drink, and for the first time I saw a quite frightening side of him. He was more than ordinarily drunk. There was a sort of out-of-hand, frenzied quality to him. The evening worried me a lot. Bill asked if I had seen Phil like this before. When I said no, Bill said, "Well, you better think about it right now." In fact, I decided I had to pull back to think it over, or even to break the engagement. I had a date to meet Phil the next night, and I was primed to have this talk, but when he appeared to pick me up, he had brought Pritch with him. As always, he was a step ahead of me. Naturally, the talk didn't take place and got postponed indefinitely. I cooled down, the fear went away, his charm took over, and that was that for the time being. Phil and my family were getting to know and like each other, but Phil went on worrying about my money. I was still working, and in fact kept working until just before the wedding. I was also busy, with my mother, buying an enormous trousseau of everything I thought I'd need. Since I had promised to live on what we both earned, I wanted to have to buy as little as possible later and as much as I could then. This trousseau saw me through for quite a long time. There was some discussion about how we would be married. We were both painfully self-conscious, Phil to the point where he wanted us to be married in New York's City Hall by Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, whom we both admired, and I was to wear a gray flannel suit. I countered with two non-negotiable demands. I wanted a slightly religious ceremony in a long wedding-ish dress and some sort of small, informal, friendly gathering at home. The compromise we arrived at was the garden at the farm at Mount Kisco, which I considered more home than the Washington house. Neither one of us was religious in the formal sense, but I wanted something more religious than a judge, and through Mother we found a very nice low-key Lutheran minister. We were married at Mount Kisco on June 5, 1940. The guests were the two justices for whom Phil worked, and their wives, the Reeds and the Frankfurters, as well as some of our Hockley friends, my family, and a few other close friends, among whom, luckily for us, was Edward Steichen. Phil and I would never have brought in a photographer, but Steichen had his camera along with him and didn't have to be asked. We were delighted to have his photographs, which I still cherish. My dress was designed by me and made to order at Bergdorf Goodman. It was long, as I had wanted, and austerely simple but beautiful, made of heavy eggshell silk, with a scarf edged with my grandmother's lace. I carried orchids, and wore orange blossoms in my hair, but no veil. My sister Ruth was my attendant, and Pritch was Phil's best man. As Phil said, the biggest best man anyone ever had. At lunch before the wedding, Phil, Pritch, and Butch Fisher started arguing with Felix about a case that had been handed down by the Supreme Court just 2 days earlier, which Joe Lash later described as the first wartime civil liberties case. It was a case on which the young men differed violently from Felix, who had written the opinion of the court in Minersville School District versus Gobitis, saying that the state could require public school students to salute the flag, even if it was a violation of their religious beliefs. The Gobitis children in the case were Jehovah's Witnesses. Phil and Pritch particularly were deeply disturbed, even shocked, by Felix's position. Steichen was also a vocal participant in the argument. He and Biss and I and others, I'm sure my brother, all took part. Felix loved and encouraged loud and violent arguments, which everyone usually enjoyed, but this time the argument went over the edge into bitter passion. Felix deeply believed in the obligation to salute the flag. The fight grew so intense that at one point great large tears rolled down Pritch's reddened, rotund cheeks. Everyone was upset. The argument went on and on, with Felix at another point saying, as Biss recalled, "Everybody always talks about me as a liberal, but I never was one." Finally, the butler came in and announced that the minister had been waiting for an hour, and Felix broke up the argument by grabbing my arm with his always iron hand and saying, "Come along, Kay. We will go for a walk in the woods and calm down." And we did. We then proceeded with the ceremony, after which we had a slightly larger reception to which my aunts, uncles, and cousins were invited. Then Al Phillips, the much-loved family chauffeur, drove Phil and me to the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. Originally, we had planned to stay at the Essex House, but Phil found out there was a strike there and felt we should not start married life by crossing a picket line. I agreed. We tried to look non-bridal entering the hotel, managing somehow until Phil extended his arm to register, and out fell a lot of rice. My mother had filled our room with fresh flowers from Mount Kisco. We stayed in New York a night or two, seeing a few friends. My sister Flo, who had married the character actor Oscar Homolka, came to see us in the Carlisle, and was announced via the room clerk, "Mrs. Homolka to see Mrs. Graham," my first public encounter with my new name, which I very much enjoyed having. After a few days, we sailed on a steamship for Bermuda, with me taking along an absurd amount of luggage, including, incredibly, a trunk. We stayed at the Horizons on Coral Beach, where we had a room with a small porch attached as a sitting room. I had taken along War and Peace, and Phil had equally heavy reading. One day we lent our room to a young army couple, also on their wedding trip. When we got back from a day's bicycling, they said, "My, you have a lot of books in your room. Nothing but a slap and a tickle in ours." Phil wrote his sister Mary while we were there, congratulating her on the birth of a baby and telling her of the joys of Bermuda, its unbelievable flowers, the color of the sea, the distinctly not-of-this-world quiet. He added, "She who is wife looks every day more like health." Despite our concerns about the fall of France, we went on doing very traditional things, bicycling, playing tennis, swimming, and reading. Tennis together had certain tensions built into it, which emerged only later. I had played a little all my life, but liked it increasingly, especially after escaping Biss's shadow. Phil had played less, but since it was something I enjoyed, he gamely entered into it, and in time grew better, always compensating for any inadequacies on the court with his wit, which began lovingly, but often ended up with a sharp and upsetting edge. We had one hilarious exchange while still in Bermuda that remained in our lore. We were playing doubles, and Phil missed an easy shot. I said, "Oh, well, they say he has a fine mind." Shortly afterwards, I missed one. Phil retorted, "And they say her family spent millions on her game." After the honeymoon and a short stay at Mount Kisco, we went down to Washington to see about our new house, which we had rented for the coming year, and then set out for Florida in the Buick convertible I had inherited from my brother. I had only the dimmest notion of Phil's family, never having met any of them. Nor had I much sense, from having lived in Washington, Chicago, and San Francisco with Mount Kisco summers, what the South was like, or what the country outside cities was like. As we entered Florida, I saw a sign in front of an apartment house that read, "No dogs or Jews allowed," and was deeply shaken, never having seen or experienced anything so ugly. We drove down Route 1 and arrived at the stone house that Phil's parents had built when Bill was born. The farm itself looked large and prosperous, but flat and sandy, where the Everglades swamps had been developed and drained into ditches and canals. We stayed at the house with Phil's father, his stepmother Hilda, whom Ernie had married in 1936, and his very young half-brother Bob, their somewhat spoiled only child. It was not an easy meeting for them or for me. Hilda was charming, warm, and welcoming. Ernie studied me over the top of his newspaper. He was shy, but did his best to be jovial and affectionate. One day, when I was lying on the couch in the living room writing thank-you notes, I was startled to be spat on by the 3-year-old Bob. Phil's brother Bill later told me that this was, alas, Bob's habit at that point in his life. I thought, in my paranoid way, that there must be a message there. Bob outgrew all this, of course, and developed into a highly successful, natural, and excellent politician, very different from the older 3 children, but extremely able. He became governor of Florida and is now senator, a strange fulfillment of both his father's and Phil's ambitions. He has all the Graham family brains and charisma, and a great deal more stability than Phil had. Miami was difficult for me for many reasons. It was southern, and no one had ever suggested to me that the South was still significantly different from the rest of the country, certainly more sexist in atmosphere. Women lunched with each other and talked household problems, which I was still unaware existed. I was tremendously reassured at lunch with my old Washington friend, Mary Coots Beelan, whose husband was in Florida working for Pan American Airlines, when she told me that she too knew nothing about vacuum cleaners and washing machines. I tried, and Phil's family and friends tried, but the reality was that I knew nothing about farming or about Florida politics, which were the bonds between Phil and his father. Still, I worked hard at being interested as we drove around the farm looking at the cows and the crops. Phil's college friends seemed unlike anyone I knew, and I didn't know how to relate to them. One of our more traumatic evenings was spent on a Chamber of Commerce boat ride with some of these old friends. This was a double cultural shock, for I had never encountered a Chamber of Commerce group before, much less the one in Miami, then still a comparatively small town. We played a game called Sniff, in which a cigarette wrapper paper was passed from nose to nose. You had to keep it up by inhaling until you passed it on. If you let it drop, you had to kiss the man with whom the catastrophe occurred. It was a modified version of the kids' game of post office. This strange game reduced me to total pulp. I didn't know whether to laugh it off or engage in it. Today, of course, I see that I was ridiculously uptight and shy, but then I couldn't help wondering if I was going to be spending the rest of my life playing Sniff with the Chamber of Commerce. I wept on the way home out of worry and fear that I couldn't cope. Phil stopped the car, hugged me, and told me not to worry. These were his old friends, but he too had grown away from them. He loved them, but no longer saw much of them, and we wouldn't be doing this kind of thing forever. I recovered, and we survived the rest of the 3-week visit, and eventually some of the main figures from his Miami youth became my good friends and stayed so. While we were in Florida, I also met Mary, Phil's sister, who adored him. Mary had a needlessly hard life. She was very gifted and bright, but not beautiful. She had wanted to go north to a dress design school and was not allowed to go. She also had a much older beau whom she loved but wasn't allowed to marry. I suppose it might have been different had her mother lived. Mary was difficult about her stepmother, Hilda, who was not much older than she, and whom Ernie had met on a bus trip shortly after his first wife's death. Mary fought the idea of the marriage and fought with Hilda. Phil had his own reservations, but as usual was the peacemaker in the situation and supported Hilda, who was awfully nice. Ernie needed her, and I got along well with her. While we were in Florida, Phil received a birthday letter from my mother, telling him how happy she was that he and I were married, and how she had never dreamed she could accept someone so spontaneously into our mystic circle. She also wrote, "When I think how useful you and Kay will be in the making of the new world that lies in wait for us, I almost envy you both such an opportunity and such a life. Let me add one word about the conversation on money, which we began on the terrace of the cabin but never completed. You were just saying, when we were interrupted, that money is a danger because it makes people soft. That is true, especially if they grow up with it. But for people like you and me, who had our own way to make during our most formative years, there is also another danger. I have driven myself mercilessly all my life, first out of fear of getting soft, and later from habit. This has been so intense an obsession that I fear it affected Eugene and the children almost too much, and created an almost restless ambition in everybody. You are so strong and sensible that you need not fear softening, need not even fear the opposite effect which it had on me. But I thought it worth mentioning, so that you and Kay will feel free to use what you have to good purpose, without complexes of one sort or the other. When you left, you said, 'You can trust me with your daughter, Mrs. M.' Let me reply, as my birthday message, that I never trusted anybody more in any and all respects." We started back north on August 1st and arrived in Washington a few days later. We stayed at Crescent Place until the furniture I had so carefully chosen with my mother arrived at our new house at 1814 37th Street, and then, in the late summer of 1940, we began our married life together in our first home. Chapter 9. We quickly and easily settled into our little house, which we rented unfurnished for $80 a month. The house, just outside Georgetown, behind Western High School, was in a pleasant, convenient, unpretentious neighborhood of row houses called Burleith. It had a tiny living room into which you walked immediately on entering, a dining room and a small kitchen. On the second floor was a nice bedroom over the living room and two little rooms that became studies for each of us. There was a day bed for guests in Phil's study. At the back of the house was a screened-in porch and a postage-stamp yard, taken up mostly by a small tin-roofed single-car garage. The house was furnished sparsely, in classic modern furniture, reflecting my taste at the time. Since the furniture was a gift from my parents, it was all made to order. Luckily, Phil was blissfully unaware of how much things like that cost, so he didn't protest. We bought living room curtains from Woodward and Lothrop. This little house helped us to accomplish what Phil and I both wanted, to live as our contemporaries did. Because of Phil's insistence and my agreement that we live on our combined salaries, and because mine was so little to begin with, my first inclination was to stop work and be a stay-at-home wife, learn to cook and keep house. Phil was horrified by the idea. He said it would be terrible to be working late and have me anxiously waiting at the door with a lemon pie. Furthermore, he really wanted me to go on working and decided we could pay a maid with what I earned. So the superb Mattie Jeffress entered our lives. A friend of my mother's laundress, Mattie came each day before breakfast and stayed through dinner with 2 half-days off, if I remember correctly. She did the cleaning and personal laundry as well as the cooking. For this, I blush to admit, we paid her all of $15 a week. Phil was earning $3,600 a year as a law clerk, which he pointed out was far from a sacrifice, since at that time this was equal to or somewhat more than the beginning salaries in law firms. I was earning about $1,500 a year. We had one small cushion, a $500 wedding present from an aunt, which I thought I could use for extras like theater and travel tickets. In a sense, Phil was almost as spoiled and unaware of finances as I was, having gone straight from law school into the luxurious arms of life at Hockley. I began to learn how to live on a different scale. The enormous trousseau I'd bought spared me from worrying about clothes, but it was clear that I hadn't the remotest idea about the particulars of domestic life. And, given the hard-working Mattie, there was still a great deal I didn't have to learn. A hamburger or scrambled eggs on her nights off were almost beyond my competence, for instance. There are still odd lacunae, I confess. I have never in my life pressed a dress. I was driven to a frenzy of small economies, doing ridiculous things to save money, like taking the laundry to Tolman's, the local cleaner, rather than having it picked up, because it saved 10 cents a pound. Of course, Tolman's also ruined the linen monogrammed sheets my mother had given me for my trousseau, but I had no idea that these were very special, since that's what I had slept on all my life. When we moved into our house in September 1940, I began keeping a little accounts book, dutifully noting every penny spent, including the cost of gas and oil for the car, stamps, groceries, even our personal allowances, which were $9 each per week. The entries taper off in October, and there are no more after November, so obviously I quickly tired of this kind of accounting. But except for the $500 wedding present, I never used a cent of my own until 2 years later, when Phil went into the army. Even when I got pregnant, I wore borrowed clothes to supplement my inexpensive department store maternity dresses, and looked very dowdy, I'm sure, out of a driven desire to live up to our agreement. Yet, despite my overdoing it, it was good for me, and for us both, to live on our salaries. In fact, most of what Phil decreed and I assented to was good for us, and we were having a great time. Our friends continued much the same that year, with the Hockley boys, especially Pritch, Bill Sheldon, and John Ferguson, being among our closest. At the same time, several new people entered our lives. Pritch started taking out a beautiful half-English girl named Evangeline Bell, who was Attorney General Francis Biddle's secretary assistant. I grew even closer to Evangeline later, after she married David Bruce. Joe Rao, one of the great fighting liberals, and his wife Oli became our great friends during this time. We also got to know Joseph Alsop better. He was not that much older than we were, but seemed at least a generation ahead in his social life and experience. Also important to us that year were the Romilies, Esmond and Jessica, or Decca as she was known. Decca was Jessica Mitford, one of the famously eccentric Mitfords. The very young Decca met Esmond Romilly, her second cousin and a nephew of Winston Churchill's, at a dinner party, and asked him if he was going to fight with the International Brigade in Spain to take her with him. He agreed, and off they went together, fell in love en route, and created a terrible public storm, during which Anthony Eden, then foreign minister, sent a destroyer to retrieve Decca. In February 1939, Decca and Esmond came to America, and it was sometime that year that I met them, was charmed, and invited them to Mount Kisco for the weekend. They were surprised to find the atmosphere there so congenial, and my parents so warm and welcoming, remarking that such open warmth didn't exist in England. The Romilies took off on a tour of the United States, heading south to New Orleans, but they took a wrong turn somewhere, and wound up in Miami, where they got a job in a bar whose owners needed $1,000 for a liquor license. Esmond flew up to Washington to ask my father for a loan. He had a big argument ready, complete with a list of assets in England that could be used as collateral. My father gently said, "You don't need to explain foreign exchange, Esmond," and promptly lent him the money, for which Esmond procured a half interest in the bar. When the war intensified, Esmond volunteered for the Canadian Air Corps, and tragically died in a bomber not long afterwards. Decca stayed on in Washington for a while, remarried, and later became a famous investigative journalist. She remained my dear friend until her recent death. Another key figure who entered our lives was Jean Monnet. In late 1940, Monnet arrived in the United States, an unknown but vitally important figure in the world and in the war. He had been in England when France fell, and arrived here not only unknown, but with no official title, no formal portfolio, and no platform except his own brain and personality. Monet had been nominated by Churchill to be part of the British Supply Council in Washington, and his mission from the Free French and the British was to get supplies built up and moving. Monet was proof positive that if someone is brilliant, political, and concentrated, he can make a power base where none exists. And he went on doing it all his life, after the war working on his idea for a united Europe. His mode of operation was to know the right people, those who had the knowledge, the power, and the will to move things, then to learn what made things move, and to be constantly pushing the levers of power. He was very selective about whom he saw and how he used his time. He never made small talk, and he always kept to the point in his discussions, at meetings, or even at dinners. Phil hero-worshipped him. At one Sunday lunch on our terrace, many years later, with just the three of us together, when Phil and I were praising him, Jean shook his head modestly and protested, "I've only had one idea, but that was a good one." But the overwhelmingly dominant influence in our lives that first year was Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, for whom Phil was now clerking. Felix and his wife, Marion, were friends of the Biddles, the Atchisons, the Bob Lovetts, and later the Jack McCloys, the Jean Monnets, and the French ambassador, Henri Bonnet, and his wife, and we were lucky enough to get to know them all. Though Phil and Felix had become close when Phil was still in law school, their mutual interests and bright, quick natures now brought them even closer together. Phil's love of politics met its match in Felix Frankfurter. The year Phil served as Felix's law clerk can only be described as rollicking. It definitely had a Rover Boys quality to it. Our friend and Hockley co-dweller, Edwin McIlwain, was clerking with Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, Ed Huddleston was with Justice Frank Murphy, and of course Pritch was always around, even though now working for the executive branch of the government. Felix being Felix, our lives were intertwined. He was all enveloping. That year there were more or less continual phone calls or visits to our house or his, and constant gossip and jokes about people on the court or what was going on there. Our mornings always got off to a slow start. Phil had a lifelong inability either to get up in the morning or to go to bed at night. I am a morning person and a dormouse at night. The phone would often ring in the morning, and Felix would say, "Where is Phil?" "On his way, Judge," I would respond, using the title we always gave him, while simultaneously kicking Phil out of bed and helping him rush out. Phil had bought a second-hand Oldsmobile, painted a weird shade of green by some previous owner, in which he would pick up the justice at his house in Georgetown and drive him to work and home again. They would talk, argue, and gossip non-stop. Felix often dictated to Phil, who typed while the justice strode up and down composing. When Felix's prose occasionally turned elaborate, purple, or bromidic, Phil, disapproving, simply stopped typing. If they disagreed about an opinion, arguments would go on and on until Felix was either influenced or simply decided. Felix was so tolerant that at times his original opinion would simply not get written. But when strong emotions were involved, the arguments could go on for months. During one case about which Phil and Felix disagreed strongly, Phil, looking disgruntled, came in after dropping the justice at his house on 30th Street. Apparently, they had argued all the way home. As soon as he walked into the house, the phone rang, and the argument continued unabated until, to my surprise, I heard Phil say, "Well, I don't care what you do, Judge. I just don't want to see you make yourself look silly," with which he banged down the phone. I don't remember what the case was, but I do remember that they kept delaying writing the decision while the argument raged on. Finally, they worked all night to finish writing the opinion at the very last possible moment before the court adjourned, and then returned home in the early morning in a cab, Felix so tired he didn't focus on the driver's asking for his address. Phil quoted the taxi driver as looking back at this exhausted man and saying, "What's the matter? You stupid or something?" Another day, the justice came into our house with Phil, grabbed my arm very tightly, as he often did, sometimes so tightly that it hurt, and asked, "Kay, did Phil tell you what Hughes said on the court the other day?" "No, he didn't, Judge," I replied. "Phil, why didn't you tell Kay? You should have told her. Holmes told his wife everything." Felix had boundless energy and ebullience and a tremendous joie de vivre. He was cerebral, of course, but he was also emotional. He loved engaging in verbal dueling over issues, and he loved certain kinds of people, particularly those whose ideas of right and justice jibed with his own. But he also liked people who disagreed with him and stood up to him, if they were very smart and were within his mental spectrum. It wasn't enough to be intelligent if you bored him or were pedestrian or had a literal mind. Because the Frankfurters were childless, Felix seemed to adopt as his intellectual sons the young Harvard law students who interested and amused him, hence the fullness of the relationship with the law clerks and their families. He loved laughter and gossip, and he encouraged the extreme irreverence of his favorite students and liked to be challenged by them. To an outsider, brought up with old-fashioned manners, the boys seemed breathtakingly rude, but Felix didn't see it that way. The shouted arguments and insults were simply his preferred form of communicating. Pritch was particularly irreverent. Someone reported that at a law clerk's dinner, Pritch sat slumped over a conference table, drumming his fingers with his eyes half shut, while the arguments raged. Suddenly Felix looked down the table and said, "Pritch, what are you doing?" Pritch looked up and said, "Counting the digressions in your argument." Felix roared. Since Phil was spending long hours at the court, I went back to work on the Post, writing stories for the Brains section of the Sunday paper, now called Outlook. This was a much more intense writing experience than any I had had, and was sometimes hard for me. Once Phil found me at 2 in the morning, hunched over my typewriter, pecking desperately away. I was stuck in the middle of a story, unable to go on. He asked me a few questions, wrote out a few paragraphs, unstuck me, and went back to bed. I wrote on such subjects as the broadcaster's fight with ASCAP, propaganda groups and the America First Committee, Mrs. Roosevelt's beginning her third term, the Harry Bridges trial, the D.C. Juvenile Court, the Cherry Blossom Festival in spring in Washington, Pan American Day, and one piece entitled Brain Trust Gone, But Professors Are Still Here. I joined the Women's National Press Club, recommended by Casey Jones, who wrote a letter in my behalf saying I was a thoroughly competent reporter. The Post was still operating from its plant on E Street, several doors away from the National Theater. The entire building was perilous and problematic. Everything in it was old, except some of the people. The small dark lobby housed a cashier and a counter where back copies of the paper were sold and the public was dealt with. There was a small cage-like elevator run by a man who had to manage the old-fashioned gate, and a dangerous ride in it took you past the city room on the second floor to the editorial offices, women's department, and the editors' and publishers' offices in the front of the building on the third floor. The local newspaper war was heating up. Sissy Patterson's merging the Times and the Herald made the Post third in circulation behind her combined circulation and the Star. My father often complained that while the other Washington papers were first in advertising and in circulation, the Post was first in operating expenses. The Scripps Howard afternoon tabloid, The News, was still much read at lunchtime. My father continued to run the Post with zest. He enjoyed being the publisher, and his employees enjoyed working for him. They had begun to refer to him affectionately as Butch, at least behind his back, which he loved and considered a term of respect. Although the Post ran a deficit in 1940 of $750,000, and even more the next year, he was working hard at winnowing down the loss. In the summer of 1941, he proposed sharing the progress of the paper, there were no profits, with his employees by offering to divide 2/3 of any improvement over the previous year's results among them. The advertising lineage of the Post was less than 1/2 that of the Star, but circulation was up to 130,000, compared with the 50,000 in 1933 when my father bought it. Also in the summer of 1941, Time magazine did a piece on the Post, calling it the capital's sole big league newspaper. It has become a journal of national importance, a reading must on Capitol Hill, an institution of high character and independence, a force for good in its bailiwick. In a wonderfully hick response that appeared on page 1, the Post said, "There can be no stretched headbands around the Post. This newspaper has just started to grow." Whatever the response, this must have been an exciting accolade for a paper so new in its regeneration and still so far behind the dominant and wealthy Star in local prestige. The progress made was a tribute to my father's tenacity in the face of great difficulties and what at times seemed a hopeless case. He would moan and groan over his breakfast tray, brought to him at my mother's bedside, exclaiming, "I think I'll sell the Post." She always succeeded in encouraging him and bucking him up at the low moments. Phil and I were both ardent Roosevelt partisans, although since the District of Columbia had no vote, our support was just talk. My parents, like many other district residents in 1940, were passionately pro-Wilkie. Mother, in her usual style, became a friend as well as a supporter of the Wilkies. I suspect, with hindsight, that Wilkie was a fine candidate, although we related to Harold Ickes's condescending description of him as the barefoot boy from Wall Street. Our first Christmas together we spent in bed with the flu. First I collapsed, then Phil, on Christmas Eve. We had to turn away our two guests and spent the day on the second floor with a little artificial 8-inch Christmas tree and a few visitors and phone calls, the saddest one being from my brother on his way to Boston to be married to Mary Adelaide Bradley, a research student whom he knew at Johns Hopkins and who had been a year ahead of me at Vassar. The flu kept us from going to the wedding. The little tree remained for years, sentimentally, among our Christmas decorations. By this time, as the war in Europe went on escalating, English children were pouring into the United States to seek refuge from the falling bombs. The Frankfurters had added great excitement to their house by taking on the three young children of Gilbert Murray, the famous Greek scholar at Oxford, who was a friend of Felix's. My father took on an entire nursery school of 15 children and their teachers, rented a large country house near Warrenton, Virginia, furnished it hastily, and lodged them there for the duration of the war. It was called Clovercroft School. When France fell, my father brought over to America two families of his French relatives, who, being Jewish, were in danger. He supported them, helping the men get jobs and providing money to help educate the children here. Unfortunately, his cousin, Leon Zadok Khan, and his wife, Suzanne, declined my father's invitation to help them leave Europe, and eventually died in Auschwitz. Their son, Bertrand, a doctor who was head of the American hospital in Paris, had shot himself when France fell. Under the shock of his loss, they didn't want to leave. Bertrand's sister Jacqueline stayed in France also, and was hidden in what was originally Free France by a very brave Catholic family. She and her husband, Jacques Eisenman, were close to my father, and are still close to me. They are now well into their 90s and immensely gallant. As the court's term drew to a close in the late spring of 1941, Phil began to think more and more about what to do next. He still thought he would return to Florida to practice law and eventually go into politics, and we had made a trip to Tallahassee during which he had been interviewed and had got a job in the state attorney general's office. But back in Washington, the threat of America's getting involved in the war seemed too real for us to move to Florida. Phil concluded that we would eventually be fighting and that he would go. In the meantime, he didn't want to abandon the effort to gear up for war. He wanted to be involved. As talk of war intensified, Phil's after-hours work turned to politics, and he cast around for the place where he could be most useful. In late May, he had lunch with Robert Lovett, then Assistant Secretary of War for Air, who told Phil he should stay working in Washington until our need for soldiers and sailors shaped up a bit more. Because his own office bureaucracy was too dominated by Army colonels, Lovett decided that Phil's abilities could best be used by Harry Hopkins in the White House, where Hopkins, FDR's closest advisor, but in failing health, was living. Lovett felt there was a bottleneck in the White House, and that a good young fellow could take enough of the work off Hopkins to enable him to prepare really important things for the president. Frankfurter and Lovett both talked to Hopkins, who saw Phil one June morning in his combined bedroom and office. Phil went in weak-kneed and scared. He later wrote his father an account of the meeting. H.H. looked up, grunted good morning, and then growled, "Why the hell aren't you in the army?" I answered that I wasn't sure I shouldn't be, that you rather thought I should be, but that the best advised man I knew, the head of Naval Intelligence, had told me to wait a few months, and that I had followed his advice. He seemed to give me a passing mark on that, and then knocked out a few more balls for me to field. Why should he use me? There were hundreds of guys like me around, etc., etc. I began to wonder what was up when he quieted down and told me he did need someone who could read reports, talk to people for him, etc. Then he said he had difficulties because there was no place to put me in the White House, but that if I could get Oscar Cox to hire me at the Lend-Lease Administration and give me an office, he'd like to have me work with him 3 days a week. Cox is a fine young fellow of 35 from Maine, who, when Assistant General Counsel in the Treasury, thought up and drafted Lend-Lease, and for whom I had been about to work anyway. So I left the White House to tell Cox of events, and he told me I ought to start in for him on Wednesday, the 11th. So I did, and I've been there since. And as yet I've seen no more of H.H. Cox, who is terribly wise, told me at the start the Hopkins thing probably wouldn't work. He said H.H. was a peculiar cuss, worked very irregularly, and probably would never get a real assistant. But he said I'd be just as happy and useful with him, because he's in the heart of getting stuff across to England as counsel for the Lend-Lease Administration. The year that began with Phil's going to Lend-Lease in June of 1941 and ended with his going into the Army the following summer was one of the most exciting of our lives. Oscar Cox attracted able people to work for him. They in turn related well to each other and to people in jobs with access to higher-ups. In this way, they could constructively pull the levers of power and make government work more effectively than it otherwise would have. Oscar was himself one of those superstars secure enough to want the best around them and to give people a lot of authority and then back them. One of the great influences on all of those who worked in Lend-Lease was Ben Cohen, a good friend of ours, then a minister without portfolio, who in early 1942 was part of a self-constituted group of men who were making sure arms production was on target. Ben never would acknowledge that a thing was illegal. He would simply rationalize it in one way or another. In trying to understand where the country was starting from, it's helpful to consider a meeting this defense watchdog group held in early June. Someone brought along the current Time magazine, which contained a footnote revealing the Russian losses of planes and other machines of war. The men figured out that these losses were greater than this country even had on order. While the military blamed everyone but itself for not having realized how big the war would be, this group of lawyers was able to demonstrate to the powers in charge, including the president, how bad the situation really was and how little the United States was doing to prepare for war. The competition for the few supplies we were producing was fierce, from our own Army, Navy, and Air Force, as well as from the British, the Free French, and the Russians. Roosevelt had spoken the year before about clouds of planes and of becoming the arsenal of democracy. One day, Phil and Joe Rao were looking at the top-secret statistics, for which they had clearance, of the Office of Production Management. When they read that only one 4-engine bomber had been delivered to the Army during August, they saw their chance to push for the importance of doing more and wrote a memorandum to be sent to the president. 3 hours later, a hot memo came back from Hopkins saying, "You shouldn't bother the president with things like this, and besides, it isn't true." The very young men, Phil was 26 at the time and Joe just 3 years older, felt that the world was coming to an end. They'd misled the president. They'd have to leave Washington. They rushed down to see Bob Nathan, director of research in the Office of Production Management and the originator of the book of statistics from which the memo had been drawn. Nathan got out his yellow backup sheets, while Joe and Phil sat there preparing to die. Nathan kept looking at his papers and making marks with a pencil. Finally, he said, "I made a mistake." Just as Phil and Joe were about to collapse, Nathan said, "There wasn't one 4-engine bomber delivered in August. There were no 4-engine bombers delivered in August. The one I counted was delivered after August 31st. One Sunday, we went out to have lunch at the log cabin owned by the Edward Burlings in the nearby Virginia woods. That day, one of those present was the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, and the arguments on preparedness were being waged at the top of everyone's lungs. Of course, I worried that Patterson was unused to this mode of discourse and would think that everyone arguing was insane, and when we got home, I told Phil that their manners in front of this august figure had been appalling. When Phil came home the next day, he said, "I guess we didn't offend Patterson too much. He called me today and asked me to go to work for him." Phil didn't, but so much for my nervous nanny-bred worries. Soon afterwards, on another Sunday in early December 1941, my parents had some guests to lunch at their own Virginia cabin. I was there, but Phil and Joe Rao were at their office working on the report to Congress that Lend-Lease had to make every 3 months. In the middle of lunch, someone from the post called to say the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Phil and Joe had gone out to a late lunch, and on the way back, Larry Fly, head of the Federal Communications Commission and of the War Communications Board, spotted them and stopped his car, shouting to them that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Joe said, "Thank God!" Phil said, "Shut up!" "I was so depressed we weren't preparing for war," Joe told me many years later, "that my reaction was, 'Thank God!'" And Phil, whose reactions were always the quickest, realized that there could be an anti-Semitic kickback, and the last thing any Jew should say is, "It's good." They both went immediately to try to enlist, but were rejected for a variety of reasons, all later dropped. Pearl Harbor was followed quickly by Roosevelt's solemn declaration of war. With the realization of what Pearl Harbor meant, Congress was flooded with requests from the different services, all competing with each other and uncoordinated. Bob Nathan was called on to ensure that there wouldn't be airplanes without wings or tanks without armor. In order to be more effective in moving the country to a wartime footing, some of this group of young men, including Phil, who were already working through Lend-Lease and other agencies, started meeting regularly at Bob Nathan's apartment. These men, calling themselves the Goon Squad, were all trying to do the same thing in different agencies, waging a magnificent battle against bureaucracy and red tape, at times amazingly successful at getting things done. There was such dispersion of authority in the government, until the War Production Board was created, that this informal group of mostly quite young men with absolutely no formal authority was actually able to step into the vacuum and compensate partially for that lack of a center. This chaos was finally resolved when Jimmy Burns went to the White House in overall charge. He had a small staff, of which Ben Cohen and Pritch were a part. If the Goon Squad recognized some problem, Ben and Pritch would tell Burns, who could get it fixed. Until that time, one art the Goon Squad developed for making known its concerns was that of leaking information, partly to Al Friendly, who had come to the Post from the Washington Daily News early in 1939 and who was reporting on the defense buildup, and partly to Drew Pearson, who was writing his very popular and widely distributed national column with Bob Allen. Pritch was thought by the group to be leaking too much and too often to Drew Pearson, who was a personal friend, so one evening he was told that he should stop, that his leaking was doing more harm than good. 2 weeks later, the group decided that something ought to be leaked to Pearson and asked Pritch to leak it. "Are you sure?" asked Pritch. "Yes," said the group. "Well, all right then," Pritch said. "I've already done it." Phil seemed to wear one hat in the Lend-Lease administration and another in the Office of Emergency Management. Although nominally he was based in these agencies, practically he was all over the place. Wherever he worked, he acquired a reputation as an expediter. He was gone from his office so much that his friends said his secretary spent her time knitting sweaters. For several months in the spring of 1942, he was detached from the legal division of Lend-Lease at the request of Bert Evatt, who was Foreign Minister of Australia and had been Chief Justice there, and who asked him to work for Australia as liaison to Lend-Lease. So he worked full-time with the Australians, particularly after the Japanese invaded the Australian territory of New Guinea. Later, when Phil went to the Post, 8 of his friends wrote a highly laudatory letter about him to the Post's editor, a tribute that best describes some of what Phil was doing in the year between his clerkship for Frankfurter and the time he enlisted. As much as or more than any single person, Graham was responsible for the increased production of high-octane gas early enough to make the strategic bombings and air operations of 1944 and 1945 possible. It was he who played a major role in generating and executing the measures necessary to put the V-loans in operation so that much of our war production could in fact be stepped up. Subcontracting and the enlisting of smaller firms in the manufacture of war supplies were materially increased by his efforts. The V-loan legislation, which allowed for the loan of money to small businesses to help them convert to the war effort, was typical of Phil's ability to cut red tape. He worked on it for many months, and finally it was completed, but had to be signed by certain officials before it went to Congress. To reduce the bureaucratically mandated time it would take to procure all of the required signatures, Phil got in a taxi, carried the bill from one individual to another, had it signed, and took it to the Hill himself. Under this legislation, hundreds of millions of dollars were loaned. By late 1941, having had a miscarriage just a few months earlier in the initial stages of pregnancy, I was pregnant again, with the baby due in May. The miscarriage had been profoundly upsetting, as though my whole physical being had begun to move toward a goal that was suddenly wrenched away from me, leaving me bereft. So I was deliriously happy to be pregnant once more. Phil, who had been rejected initially by the Army because of eyesight problems and because he was married, had decided to wait for our baby to be born before doing anything more about the military, despite his determination to join. In one exchange between us, I had deplored the fact that we had the bad luck to live in a world with Hitler, to which Phil responded, "I don't know, maybe it's a privilege to have to fight the biggest son of a bitch in history." By May, I was experiencing a lethargy even greater than usual. Pregnancy seemed to dull my mind and sap my energy, perhaps just from the sheer exhaustion of carrying that much extra weight around. My listlessness was interspersed with bursts of activity on the cooking, entertaining, and shopping fronts. I wasn't working any longer, and as I wrote to my friend Sidney Hyman, "I resigned myself quite contentedly to the life of a vegetable. I went to cooking school in the morning, had lunch with friends, sat in the sun with other pregnant ladies, talked, gossiped, did everything in short that's in the books, including laying out my husband's slippers and smoking jacket. I'm serious, I assure you. And the funniest part of all is that I liked it." I had bought the things we needed for the baby, including 3 rubber sheets with the crib, although Phil protested that no child of his would need them, and I had gained a lot of weight and was quite uncomfortable, particularly when it started to get hot in Washington. We were beginning to think the baby was overdue, so I suggested to my doctor that he induce labor, which he did, but it was too soon and the baby wasn't ready. When, after 3 days, it finally began to be born, the cord was around its neck, a situation that ordinarily could be dealt with. Apparently, that night, with wartime help shortages, the doctor was delivering several babies at once, and by the time he got to my problem, it was too late. We lost the baby boy. When I came to after the long ordeal, I looked at Phil and groggily asked, "Is the baby all right?" When he said no, I couldn't believe it. I had never heard of anyone losing a baby, and was so disbelieving that I was sure it couldn't possibly be true. But it was all too real. I was devastated. I will never forget getting back to the house where Phil had removed all of the baby's things so that it wouldn't be even more painful. I began to realize not only that there was no baby, but that Phil would now be leaving to go into the army, and I would be alone. It was a terrible anguish, compounded by a desperate feeling that we'd never have children, and an even greater fear that something might happen to him, all the worst dreads combined. Phil was wonderful to me, and we both were helped by my father. My mother was so upset I don't remember seeing her until several weeks afterwards. So Phil did enlist in the army, and before he was to leave, we had a reunion at Mount Kisco that included my brother Bill, who was going into the medical corps, and his wife Mary. One night, while we were all at dinner, my mother, still very Republican, started picking on the young New Dealers, who, of course, were not only our friends, but by then were all either gone to the military or working in defense. I was still emotionally vulnerable, and her barbs and jibes about these young men as draft dodgers were like a match thrown onto a gasoline-soaked bonfire. She and I had an enormous and horrible set to. I knew that she was still spending her time on her book about Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and Mann. In addition, despite the war, Mount Kisco was continuing to operate on its normal luxurious scale. For example, I knew she had laid in a great deal of sugar, which was in short supply or already rationed. So I demanded to know what she herself was doing to help the war effort, writing this remote treatise in a house full of servants and hoarded sugar. She retorted by asking what I was doing about it. Since I had just lost my baby and was about to lose my husband to the army, I exploded into tears. We were separated by Phil and Bill, who took me upstairs. They then talked to her in forthright terms acknowledging that I shouldn't have attacked her so emotionally, but stating that in fact she really should do something more constructive than what she was doing. They suggested she turn her attention to reporting on America's war-impacted areas. And to her great credit, she took their suggestion seriously and began an earnest and constructive career as a traveling correspondent on the war and the home front. Those first few years of marriage, before the war interrupted all our lives, Phil and I had a very happy time. I grew up considerably, mostly thanks to him. What he did for me was more than helpful. It was essential. He began to liberate me from my family and from the myths they had propagated, eventually leading me down very different paths from those I had known earlier. He counterbalanced my ingrown resistance to new and different ideas, to people with whom I didn't agree politically, to not having to hew to anyone's standards but my own. Phil also brought into my life more laughter, gaiety, irreverence for rules, and originality. At the same time that he freed me in many ways from my family, Phil also grew quickly to appreciate both of my parents and got along with them better than most of their own children did. Despite his early apprehensions about my father's wealth, politics, and possible impulse to control, Phil gradually grew very close to him, ending up by becoming one of the two or three closest friends of his lifetime. He loved staying up with my father, listening to him reminisce about his life, his experiences, and his successes. Perhaps we children had all got too jaded by my father's growing habit of speaking in a monologue rather than inviting an exchange of any kind. We found ourselves almost involuntarily clicking off our minds. But Phil would respond, question, remember, and enjoy. Their blossoming relationship gave both of them great pleasure. Phil and my mother also got along well. She adored him from the beginning, and was closer to him in many ways than to me, emphasizing to the rest of us in the family that she and Phil, and only they, knew what it was like to grow up poor. He admired her, but remained far more ambivalent about her than about my father. Indeed, he was very realistic about her, and at times quite tough and critical. But though Phil was a great help to both my parents, he always insisted that we lead our own lives. He would always go to their aid if they were lonely or sick or in trouble, but he refused to be used, particularly by my mother, or to be dominated by her. When she insisted on our coming to dinner because she felt Phil should meet so-and-so, he would respond that he would be glad to keep them company when they really wanted us, but we wouldn't be just another two seats at her dinner table. Unaccustomed as I was to thinking of declining her invitations, it gradually dawned on me that he was right. Although he was much the stronger, Phil also learned from me to some extent. What I brought to him was a greater knowledge of the world's ways, an appreciation of art and music and beauty, and of course, the world of my parents, the Post and Washington, all of which he loved. I also brought him some stability. But always it was he who decided and I who responded. From the earliest days of our relationship, for instance, I thought that we had friends because of him and were invited because of him. It wasn't until years later that I looked at the downside of all this and realized that, perversely, I had seemed to enjoy the role of doormat wife. For whatever reason, I liked to be dominated and to be the implementer. But although I was thoroughly fascinated and charmed by Phil, I was also slightly resentful when I thought about it, at feeling such complete dependence on another person. As the war came to rule our lives, I was amazed that we could continue to be so happy despite the condition of the world. What I remember most from those first years of marriage was our fun with each other, the constant growth and learning, and always a lot of laughter. Chapter 10. Early on the morning of July 27, 1942, Phil left for the Army Air Corps as a private, going first to Fort George Meade, the neighboring Army installation in Maryland. The dreadful moment of our parting came at the Greyhound bus terminal in downtown Washington, already a depressing place, but made more so by the sight of nervous recruits huddling together. Although I knew I was going to join him wherever he was shipped, the unknowns of the parting got the best of me, and I embraced him, turned, and fairly dove through the door of the terminal as he joined the group of jittery inductees. I happened to look down just as I fled, discovered that my slip was showing, and decided that once more I had failed in a crisis. Phil wrote me from Fort Meade the very next day, describing in great detail his first impressions of Army life, the barn-like reception center, the primitive cafeteria with surprisingly good food, the physical inspection, and the unair-conditioned barracks in which he sat on the edge of his cot, using his toilet kit as a lap desk on which to write. The 13 men from D.C. had stuck together, with Phil sitting next to the only black man among the recruits on the bus ride from Washington. Phil had quickly noticed that the man was being ignored and readily established that Jim Crow was very active in the Army, with the one Negro being pointedly cast out of the group. After a short time at Fort Meade, Phil was sent for basic training to Atlantic City, where I joined him and began my life as a camp follower. I found a room in a boarding house not far from the boardwalk, where we shared a nightly 2.5 hours. Much of the rest of the time I spent watching the men marching up and down the boardwalk in the humid heat. In some ways, going to Atlantic City meant getting started on normal life again, but it was depressing for me in almost every way, from the rooming house to the damp heat to the all-too-brief visits with Phil. After a few weeks, he was hospitalized with the flu or pneumonia, and since I was not allowed to visit him, I went back to Washington to wait to hear about his next assignment. Phil wrote touchingly from the hospital, "My afternoon sleeping was rather dozing off and on, and all through it, as all through the morning, I thought of us. I was going to say you, but that isn't accurate, for I never think of anything but the two of us together. It is strange and wonderful and strengthening about us. More and more, every day for 2 years, we have become the single most important fact for me. Today, reading back magazines, I thought how horribly fakish Washington was run. And then I thought how much of this army was boarding school sadism passed on blindly, by rote. And then I realized that though those were things of importance to me, they were dwarfed by something I feel sure only you and I have. I don't know how it happened to come to us, Cattringham, but I know we must treasure it, and I know we do treasure it. Sitting around now, I get funny little thoughts all the time about how I'll get to a phone the minute I land at my new post and tell you to start on at once, about just when I may be able to squeeze a 3 or 4 day pass so we can go off together, about how after the war, all other considerations about employment must be secondary to my need of several hours a day to be together with you. I love thinking all those things. They don't come to mind out of sadness from being a little bit apart now. I think them because they are part of the knowledge of our inseparability, a beautiful piece of knowledge, Kate." Phil was always ambivalent about the Army. On the whole, it was much as he expected, and he liked it more than not. What he didn't like was its illogic. He would get frustrated by the straitjacket of the bureaucracy, the stupid constant yowlings of the non-commissioned officers, the mix of efficiency with inefficiency, ineptitude, incompetence, waste, and negligence. Fucking was the universal adjective. It seemed to apply to everything and everyone. The fucking chiseler, the fucking sergeant, the fucking camp. On the other hand, Phil loved the all-American men, among the best of whom was a young Pole from the steel mills of Pittsburgh who said it was important to trust the men, no matter what they might seem like. "These are good fellows here. I was afraid they'd be toughs, but they're not. You can trust 'em. Christ, you gotta trust 'em on the battlefield. Why not here?" Phil liked the men from whom he could get honest and useful information. How to make a bed properly. How to avoid the morning rush by shaving at night. Knowing these men gave us both a great pride in America. Many of them, although married and already parents, had enlisted because they believed in defending their country. Most of them had a peculiar mixture of gentleness and toughness. I was moved particularly by the patriotism and sacrifice of the boys from the South, who always seemed most heroic to me. At the end of 6 weeks, Phil was shipped out of Atlantic City. We knew only that his destination was one of 3 communications schools run by the Air Force. By chance, the schools were 1, 2, and 3 days away from Washington. When Phil called at the end of the 3rd day to say come right away, He was in the farthest and most remote radio school, the one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. At first I was worried about what life in Sioux Falls would be like, but then my father said he had saved the town in 1923 when he headed the Farm Loan Board and thought that he still had enough contacts to help me if all else failed. In fact, I was really pleased about the posting because I felt I would rather be in a small and unexpected place than somewhere like Atlantic City or even St. Louis. I arrived in Sioux Falls in early September and settled in within a few weeks. What we found there was a warm and friendly town with lots of pretty little white houses with service flags in the windows. The clinging odor of John Morrell's meatpacking house shared the atmosphere with the coal smoke from hundreds of barracks stoves. We never saw the supposedly picturesque falls that gave the town its name, and in fact could hardly imagine anything falling anywhere in such a great expanse of flatness. A reclaimed swamp just a mile northwest of town, flat as Florida, provided a superhighway for prairie gales. The camp was located right there, with the school building spread down its middle like an assembly line. The men went in one end the first day to learn the fundamentals of electricity and emerged from the other end as radio operators and mechanics several months later. The military camp itself had a population of 45,000, the town originally having 15,000 residents. Crowding was severe, and living quarters for the families of the servicemen were difficult to unearth. There was no possibility of my getting a decent apartment, and though a room in a house was just possible, I opted for a hotel where I could have my own bath and telephone and privacy. One thing we both quickly learned was not to believe anyone or anything about the Army. Rumors flew around constantly. For example, that the men would all go on to gunnery school from Sioux Falls, and that the average life of gunners on bombers at the front was 4 minutes. Another rumor was that the whole Air Corps would be required to have new and different uniforms, which would cost every man $85 apiece. The truth amid the rampant rumors was much harder for us than I was admitting, even to myself. We really felt for the first time in our spoiled lives what it was like to be at the bottom of the heap and miserable. It seemed as if an unseen hand was involved in a constant plot to make our lives unhappy. The world we lived in was run by half-mad civilian reserve officers recently called to duty who appeared to respond to their whiff of power by specializing in a peculiar kind of mindless brutality toward privates. Men's leaves were canceled for no reason, and the men were often punished en masse for minor infractions committed by one or two individuals. Weird things happened, like the men being ordered down on their hands and knees to smooth out the dirt for a general's visit. Hoping to master a useful tool while waiting for Phil to be off duty, I enrolled in typing and shorthand courses at the local business college, but found them hopelessly difficult. I missed some classes because of a cold and would have had to start over had Phil not gone on the day shift, allowing me to give up the courses altogether. I must admit I was relieved, especially in light of the young high school graduates who whizzed by me with their prowess. I also did some work for the Red Cross, rolling bandages with the ladies. I intended to submit stories for the Sunday Post, but somehow life in Sioux Falls grew too busy, what with movies, concerts by the draftees, church suppers, lectures, and other social events. All of this was new and strange to me. I had never observed, much less lived, life in Middle America or a small town, or experienced the great kindness of people in such a place toward strangers. A typical entertainment at a Kiwanis dinner consisted of welcoming the new members and wives, naturally not members, a short talk on some potential amendments to the club rules, a song by a young man from the local high school, and a speech by the chaplain of the Air Force School on the famous Sergeant Alvin C. York, World War I hero, whom the chaplain had once interviewed. I sat next to one of the town's oldest inhabitants, who had received a medal the year before for being a good citizen. He kept remarking on how much I could eat. Besides going out to other clubs' meetings, I joined one myself, Mrs. Private. This was a club formed by the private's wives to help each other, especially the lonely and homeless. Its slogan was, "Happier Lives for Private's Wives." Every conceivable type of private's wife was there, a good many of whom were pregnant, and most of whom had jobs, as waitresses, as salesgirls or in the meatpacking house. Some local girls married privates, though others just got in trouble. One local mother found herself with two unmarried pregnant daughters. When she complained to the colonel, he asked her how he could control thousands of men if she couldn't control her own daughters. Much of my life in Sioux Falls and elsewhere later on consisted in waiting for the hours a few times each week when Phil and I could be together. I wanted so much to have a baby, and very quickly again became pregnant, my third pregnancy, counting my early miscarriage. True to form, I started to